It is Monday, June the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you here. Coming up, U.S. trade tariffs causing tensions with the EU, China, Mexico, and Canada.
This is going to cost American consumers a lot more. It'll also cost Canadian consumers more.
President Trump's lawyers saying he can't be compelled to testify in the Russia probe.
This has never been supported in law. This has never been supported by the Supreme Court or any case law in the United States.
Also ahead, people of different faiths coming together for a Ramadan meal. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Trump administration's announcement of tariff hikes last week, accompanied by threats of more, continued to draw harsh criticism from traditional allies and adversaries alike. The AP's Ben Thomas begins our reporting.
Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross traveled to Beijing over the weekend for trade talks with China's top economic official, but the meeting ended with no joint statement, just a warning. China said while positive and concrete progress was made, no agreement will take effect if the U.S. goes ahead with threatened trade sanctions. Meanwhile, a meeting of G7 finance ministers in British Columbia became more of a G6 plus one, with Canadian Finance Minister Bill Morneau saying of U.S. tariffs,
"It's not at all constructive. It's actually destructive."
But White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow, a self-described free trader, tells Fox News Sunday President Trump is doing the right thing.
"This president from day one wants to reform the world trading system. It is not working."
Ben Thomas, Washington.
U.S. allies, including Canada and the European Union, are threatening retaliatory tariffs. Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau told NBC's Chuck Todd on the program Meet the Press on Sunday the reciprocal tariffs would hurt both U.S. and Canadian workers and consumers. He also pushed back against the argument that Canadian steel poses a U.S. security threat.
"The idea that the Canadian steel that's in military vehicles in the United States, the Canadian aluminum that makes your fighter jets, is somehow now a threat. The idea that we are somehow a national security threat to the United States is quite frankly insulting and unacceptable."
VOA's Victor Beatty speaks with University of Toronto scholar Nelson Wiseman, who says Trudeau was simply appealing to U.S. opinion. He also offering some insight into what impact might be heightened U.S. tariffs on Canadian steel and aluminum.
"This is going to cost American consumers a lot more. It'll also cost Canadian consumers more. And, you know, we now have economic advisors to the president, like Larry Kudlow, whenever he was in the private sector on television, was preaching the virtues of free trade. Now he's suggesting that Trump is perhaps the most brilliant trade negotiator in a century. We will see. When it comes to an international crisis now, we'll see how successful the U.S. is in marshaling its traditional allies. There will be a sense of less obligation to go along with the American position."
What's the status of the NAFTA talks? Have they collapsed?
Well, they hadn't collapsed, and apparently there was a deal about a month ago, and I think the American negotiators agreed to it, and Trump decided, no, we're not going ahead. So the American position changed immediately. The main American concern has been, at least in the negotiations, the auto sector in Mexico and the drive to raise Mexican wages to a minimum of $15 an hour, which would make those wages would still be way less than they are in Canada and the U.S., but they would make American and Canadian plants more competitive vis-a-vis the Mexicans when it comes to things such as assembly. You know, on that front, and my area isn't Mexican politics, but Trump is also playing into the hand of the more anti-American candidate in the Mexican election, which is in a few weeks. And that's not going to bode well, because the Mexicans might decide, well, you know, maybe we want to cut out of these negotiations. In the end, I think we'll get some sort of deal here. But again, I say I'm surprised, because I didn't think we would get to this stage, because I always thought from the beginning, if the United States cannot cut a deal with Canada, what country in the world can it cut a deal with?
Kudlow, in his interview on a separate program, says it's broader than just aluminum and steel. Can this matter be resolved between the two countries?
Kudlow is raising the points that Trump is putting out. Kudlow has, like Giuliani, has become a puppet of the president. Now, mind you, they work for him, so they carry his line. But I actually don't believe that they believe a lot of what they're saying. So if we want to refocus on the agricultural field, yes, this could be a more substantive part of the negotiations. But up to now, the Americans have been signaling that their main interest in NAFTA negotiations has been in the auto sector. And another wrench they're now throwing in, which they insist, which came up in the NBC interview today, is that there be a five-year sunset clause. Well, think about that. I mean, what kind of trade deal do you have and companies making long-term investments when in 5 years from now you're back at square one and you may not have access to that market? So that makes for great uncertainty. That's why the Canadians have been relying heavily on the American business community, and they've been lobbying, the Canadians have, any American state official, federal official, bureaucrat. They've been lobbying furiously for the past year, but it doesn't seem to have had any effect. Donald Trump is very much his own man and revels in surprise and chaos. So we're in that netherworld right now, and Canada is caught up in it, as is virtually every other country. And I'm especially referring to its allies. In fact, it's sort of ironic that they've given a pass to this major Chinese telecommunications firm, which has been flouting the U.S. sanctions vis-a-vis North Korea, stealing American technology. And Trump has been on the phone with the president of China saying, no, no, we're going to help you save the jobs of this company. So, you know, what can I say? He's your president. Enjoy.
Can this issue be resolved?
The NAFTA issue? Yes.
No, not NAFTA. Just the dispute between Canada and the U.S.
Well, the dispute, I think this dispute goes beyond that, because these tariffs that have been applied aren't being applied just to Canada. I was fairly confident that that Canada would continue to be granted an exemption. I wasn't sure that Mexico would, and I didn't know what the European situation was. So I'm quite frankly surprised. I should also point out that Canada intends to introduce counter measures, and it's floated a number of ideas, but it's also indicated that they won't come into effect until July 1 because it wants to spend 2 weeks getting input from Canadians, Canadian industries, and anyone about what American products they think ought to be subject to a tariff, how much, and what the implications are of the long list of items that Canada has proposed could be subject to tariffs, including such things as everything from yogurt to cucumbers.
Nelson Wiseman is a professor of political science at the University of Toronto in Canada. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. And as we heard earlier, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross was in Beijing over the weekend for more trade talks with China. China used the occasion at first to warn the United States any trade and business agreements between the two countries would be void if President Trump carries out his threats to impose tariff hikes. And early today, a statement from the Beijing leadership indicated the trade talks were positive with concrete progress. VOA's Ira Melman speaks with University of Notre Dame finance professor Jeffrey Bergstrom for his read on trade negotiations between the U.S. and China.
Well, first of all, the Trump administration was the start of all this in terms of raising tariffs, especially on manufactured goods, steel in particular, also aluminum, but it's done it on countries around the world. So the response by China in terms of, say, voiding any trade and business agreements as a retaliatory measure is feasible. How much impact that will have is pretty limited. Basically, it's a retaliatory measure. But the notion that they are going to curtail trade and business agreements doesn't have much impact, because those could be small agreements, those could be partnership agreements, but they're not under the rules of an economic integration agreement.
How much different is the Trump policy and style in negotiating and talking with China as his predecessors?
Completely different. The U.S. president, the current U.S. president, Trump administration is starting a trade war. Historically, this is unprecedented since the 1930s, where the most similar situation would have been the Smoot-Hawley tariffs, which were brought in under Hoover, and that exacerbated the Great Recession of the early 1930s into the Great Depression with the collapse of world trade, which collapsed by about two-thirds.
Do you think this is a war of simply threats, or do you expect a trade war, a real trade war, to break out? And if so, what kind of effect is that going to have on the American and Chinese consumer?
Well, the way I see it is that a trade war exists once at least one party starts creating barriers to trade, which these tariffs on steel and aluminum will do. And then we know it's a war because the other side responds. China responds by raising tariffs proportionally to do as much damage as was done to them. Same thing for the European Union, Canada, and Mexico. So once you have one party starts creating protectionism, which is what the Trump administration is doing, and other parties partake in terms of a tit-for-tat kind of situation, you are in a trade war. The big issue is, how bad will it be?
And what would be the effect on the consumers, be they in China, be they in the United States, or even worldwide?
What happens is this is going to lower the overall volume of trade. And so in the end, employment will go down in these industries. You know, in the short run, it's going to boost employment. But, you know, within a couple of years, the collapse of the world economy will eventually hurt employment and create very high unemployment in the country and depressing economic conditions.
You're calling for the collapse of the world economy?
It depends on the degree to which this escalates. Given what they've done so far, it's damaging the U.S. economy and damaging the Chinese economy and the other economies where these are going into play. If it escalates to a much higher degree, then it could collapse the world economy. It's not at that level yet. It's just the first round. So it's a beginning, but it could stop. It could stop here. Or it could escalate. Very hard to see at this point.
Jeffrey Bergstrom is a professor of finance at the University of Notre Dame. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. In his appearance on Fox News Sunday, as we heard earlier, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow further reiterated President Trump's concerns about the way the U.S. has been treated over the years in trade negotiations.
In the world trade game, rule breaking is all over the place. That's why I think that the president is right. We have got to make reforms and we have to stand up for U.S. interests as we go along. This is so, you know, don't blame Trump. Blame China. Blame Europe. Blame NAFTA. Blame those who don't want reciprocal trading, tariff rates, and protectionism, and the right. Trump is responding to several decades of trade abuses here.
Meantime, at the weekend G7 finance ministers meeting in Canada, ministers expressed their concern and disappointment over the U.S. tariffs. U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin spoke to their concerns.
There's a lot of issues that are going on. The president's been personally involved in our trade updates. We meet with him almost every week on these issues. And again, I'm sure he will be addressing with the other leaders the trade issues.
He's referring to the G7 meeting in Quebec this week to be attended by President Trump. It will be his first official trip to Canada. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of scientists say they've discovered an area covered with dunes on Pluto's surface after studying detailed images taken in 2015 by NASA's New Horizons spacecraft. Detailing their findings in the journal Science, the team goes on to say that the dunes are made up of sand-sized grains of methane that they think were created through a process known as sublimation. That's the process of transforming a solid into a gas. This dune-covered area is less than 75 kilometers across and was found on the border of Pluto's heart-shaped ice plain, Sputnik Planitia, and a major mountain range. The grains of methane were thought to have been carried by Pluto's winds, which are said can reach anywhere from 30 to 40 kilometers per hour. Scientists also say it's likely the dunes formed within the last 500,000 years, or maybe even more recently. I am VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. President Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, says it's an open question whether Mr. Trump will answer questions from investigators who are probing Russia's meddling in the 2016 election. The president has long said he wants to answer questions from special counsel Robert Mueller, but on Sunday, Giuliani told ABC News the special counsel does not have a case for compelling the president to be interviewed.
We'll say, hey, you got everything you need. You got 1.4 million documents. You have 28 witnesses. The president has given every explanation and corrected some that were misimpressions. You got everything you need. What do you need us for?
Trump lawyers contend in a 20-page letter to Mueller before Giuliani joined the president's legal team that he cannot be compelled to testify through a subpoena and argued he could not have obstructed justice by firing FBI Director James Comey when he was leading the Russia investigation. For some perspective on all of this, VOA's Lori London speaks with criminal defense attorney Jack Rice.
This is the most aggressive approach I have ever seen from a sitting American president. This president and his team are claiming two things. First of all, that they can't force him, meaning Bob Mueller, can't force him to appear for a subpoena. And number two, he literally can't be indicted. He can't be charged with obstruction because he can pardon himself. They're literally making both of those arguments. This has never been supported in law. This has never been supported by the Supreme Court or any case law in the United States. And yet that's the argument that is being made. Essentially, what they are arguing is this, is that this president is above the law. He has the ability to control those people in law enforcement. He has the ability to hire them, or at least to move them forward. He has the ability to fire them for any and all reasons, even if they're illegitimate ones. He has the right to do it. That's what Rudy Giuliani is trying to argue right now. But the problem is there is nothing in the law that says he has the right to do that. Because if you make the argument that he can do anything he wants when he wants, that means that he could bring on specific judges he wanted to have on the bench because they were criminal. He can't do that. He can't fire them because he's trying to hide an investigation, because there's no support for that anywhere in the law. And here's the weirdest part, and this is according to this letter from January. They were making an argument about a statute, which is actually the wrong statute. You have to go back and realize that the argument that they were making actually is old law. There's new law from 2002, a new statute that applies in this particular case, and they actually missed it. It's shoddy legal research, truly. And I mean it objectively.
What do you mean they missed? What did they miss?
What they missed is this. Mm-hmm. If they make an argument about the standard and at which they can apply and say that they have the right to, this president has the right to fire anybody for any reason, even a bad one, even an illegal one.
Even if it's about someone who's investigating him.
Even if somebody finds out that he was involved in criminal activity, he has the right to fire him.
And then he's not can't be held accountable?
Exactly. That is actually the argument. Problem is you go back to a new law that was actually passed into law by Congress in 2002, mm-hmm. that says very specifically, you can't do things for the wrong reason. The problem is that the president's team from January, really tied back to June of 2017, addresses it in the wrong way, the wrong law, the wrong statute, and misses the fact that the law was actually changed in 2002. But even that runs a little too far into the weeds, because regardless, what we find is that this president actually can be subpoenaed. The president can be subpoenaed in the very way that Bill Clinton was subpoenaed. Let's think of it like this. Bill Clinton was subpoenaed because of behavior he was involved in before he became president. The investigation in this particular case could apply to a subpoena involving what this president was doing when he was running for the presidency. To make the argument you can't force him simply ignores the reality of the law that was driven by the Republicans, by Ken Starr, and specifically would apply under relatively similar circumstances and about as closely as we can possibly find in American jurisprudence. And yet, they're trying to make the argument that they can't do it. The law just doesn't work that way, and it doesn't work that way in this particular instance.
So we still don't know whether the president will sit down with a special counsel Mueller, but it's looking more and more like his lawyers don't think it's a good idea. But Mr. Giuliani said that a president cannot be subpoenaed.
I believe that Mr. Giuliani is incorrect. I believe that this president will be subpoenaed if he doesn't agree to cooperate. In the end, there's going to be a fight that runs back and forth. And the real question will be, is this president prepared to have a subpoena issued, to reject the subpoena, to have this driven to the Supreme Court with him making the argument that he really wanted to sit down in the first place? That's the real question. In the end, I believe this president is going to sit down with Bob Mueller because Bob Mueller is coming. He's knocking on the door. He has really good investigators. He has really good people. He has 17 indictments. He has 4 convictions and counting. He's coming. The question is whether or not the president will answer the door.
Criminal defense attorney Jack Rice speaking with my colleague, Lori London.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
French news agency reporting 5 new suspected cases of the deadly Ebola virus in the Democratic Republic of Congo. World Health Organization has expanded its Ebola vaccination program in the DRC. And Alan Johnson Sirleaf, who was president of Liberia during the previous Ebola epidemic in West Africa, said the vaccine trials in Guinea and now in the DRC have shown good results.
We're hoping that DRC, like others, will have a capacity to deal with it, to stop the spread. We're hoping that DRC will come out of this, you know, without the major effect, the major results that we saw in the 3 countries that were not prepared for this.
Since this latest outbreak began in early May, some 50 cases of the infection have been reported, with 25 of those fatal. More than 300 seniors at a high school in the U.S. state of Texas received their graduation diplomas, with the memory of a deadly mass shooting on campus still fresh in their minds. AP's Julie Walker reporting.
The graduating seniors from Santa Fe High School wore white stoles in tribute to the 8 students and 2 substitute teachers killed in the school shooting on May 18th. A video paid tribute to them, as did salutatorian Bailey Dobson.
Through all of the challenges life has thrown at us and will throw at us, we will remain strong. We will grow to face those challenges. If not for our sake, then for those we've lost.
A 17-year-old student identified as the shooter is being held on capital murder charges. I'm Julie Walker.
For Muslims, the month of Ramadan, May 15th to June 15th, is a time for self-reflection as well as prayer and fasting from sunrise to sunset. And then after sunset, families and friends enjoy a meal called iftar. At a mosque in Virginia, just outside of Washington, people of various faiths came to iftar to join the Muslims in prayer. VOA's Deborah Block has the story.
Allah. Here at the Dar al-Hijra Islamic Center in Falls Church, Virginia, Seton McElroy, who is Catholic, is joining Muslims in worship for the first time.
It was a spiritual experience, certainly. And it's impressive, and I love that I could have that experience with a different faith and still sort of, I don't know, still feel God even though I'm not in a church.
McElroy is among an interfaith group that were invited to one of the largest mosques in the Washington area for iftar, the evening meal Muslims eat after fasting from sunrise to sunset. Imam Naeem Beg, outreach director at the Islamic Center, says he hopes the people who do not know much about Islam would learn more about it.
I see it as my responsibility to share our faith, to share our values. Just by sitting together and eating itself brings people closer.
Jim Winkler, head of a Christian organization, the National Council of Churches, told the group he looks forward to the day when all faiths are accepted and respected.
This is what
we're really supposed to be about as believers, being together, breaking bread, talking and laughing together.
Rabbi Jerry Serrata heads a nonprofit organization of 11 different faiths, which include Islam and the Buddhist and Mormon religions.
If more people understood how much we had in common with other faiths, I think that would go a long way to reducing some of the bigotry that's out there.
Robert Watkin, a pastor at Falls Church, Virginia Anglican Church, teaches a class on building bridges with Muslims. And he brought his students so they could learn more about Islam firsthand.
The first step towards tearing down walls is really beginning to build relationships and getting to know others.
As Sophia Asidram joins other women in prayer at the mosque, she knows how important that is. Since her mother is Catholic and her father is Muslim, she decided to embrace Islam.
So it's definitely challenging having coming from a family that is, you know, divided in terms of religion. But I think that for me, the most important thing about it is, and the number one thing that I've taken away from it is kind of the importance of dialogue between the two sides.
More than anything, Imam Beg says, he hopes the interfaith visitors will take with them the beauty of Islam.
The aspect of generosity, the aspect of kindness, the aspect of taking care of your neighbor, the aspect of thinking about those who are not as blessed as we are. And I think this iftar touches upon the humanness of our faith.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Falls Church, Virginia.
Pope Francis is urging residents of a mobster-plagued Rome suburb to be courageous and side with the law. In his Sunday homily, the Pope encouraged his people, in his words, to knock down the walls of social codes that discourage people from denouncing mobsters. He called on people to shake off fear and oppression. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, John Ellison, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Monday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
At the release of the 2017 International Religious Freedom Report, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called the report a testament to the United States' historic role in preserving and advocating for religious freedom around the world.
Religious freedom is in the American bloodstream. It's what brought the pilgrims here from England. Our founders understood it as our first freedom. That is why they articulate it so clearly in the First Amendment. As James Madison wrote years before he was president or Secretary of State, quote, conscience is the most sacred of all property, end of quote.
Religious freedom, said Secretary Pompeo, was vital to America's beginning. Defending it is critical to our future. Religious freedom belongs not only to Americans, but to every individual around the world. Furthermore, advancing liberty and religious freedom advances America's interests, declared Secretary Pompeo.
Where fundamental freedoms of religion, expression, press, and peaceful assembly are under attack, we find conflict, instability, and terrorism. On the other hand, governments and societies that champion these freedoms are more secure, stable, and peaceful.
The Trump National Security Strategy clearly states America's commitment to religious liberty. Our founders understood religious freedom not as the state's creation, but as a gift of God to every person and a fundamental right for a flourishing society. The release of the 2017 International Religious Freedom Report provides the status of religious freedom in nearly 200 countries and territories and documents reports of violations and abuses committed by governments, terrorist groups, and individuals. The world has made important strides, but much work remains to be done. In that regard, Secretary Pompeo announced that the United States will host the first ever Ministerial to Advance Religious Freedom at the Department of State on July 25th and 26th of this year. The United States looks forward to identifying concrete ways to push back against persecution and ensure greater respect for religious freedom for all. The United States will not stand by as spectators, vowed Secretary Pompeo. We will get in the ring and stand in solidarity with every individual who seeks to enjoy their most fundamental of human rights.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.